This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:05. It's Tuesday, Election Day in Chicago, February 26, 2019. Thank you for voting for the WBBM Noon Business Hour. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rob Hart. 22 degrees in Chicago, but it feels like 9 above with light snow, topping out at 26 degrees this afternoon. We'll take a look at the AccuWeather forecast coming up in just a couple of minutes. The WBBM Noon Business Hour is presented by Old Second Bank, and the markets are firmly in negative territory right now at the noon hour. Let's get the latest on trading from Bloomberg and Jeff Bellinger.
And Rob, you're right. Dow Jones Industrials are down 19 points, 26,072. NASDAQ's down 15. S&P 500 is down 2.5. The Bloomberg WBBM Chicago Index is down 0.2%. Embraer shareholders have approved a deal to spin off the Brazilian company's commercial airplane division into a joint venture with Boeing. Boeing will control the venture with an 80% stake. Boeing shares are up 0.2%. The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index out today shows an advance for this month. Americans' views on current economic conditions are at an 18-year high thanks to the solid job market and the rebound on Wall Street. The government reported housing starts fell to a two-year low in December, and home price data from Case-Shiller show that home price appreciation slowed at the end of last year. Crude oil futures little change, down just 2 cents a barrel this hour. Rob, back to you.
Coming up on the Noon Business Hour, we'll talk to Greg Hines of Crane Chicago Business regarding the election today and how the various candidates, you know, their economic platforms will impact Chicago, which is the economic muscle of both Illinois and the Midwest. And we'll talk about Elon Musk's trouble with the Securities and Exchange Commission. What can you say on social media, especially if you run a publicly traded company? And then coming up at 12:49, we'll talk about the marijuana business. It's going upscale, and some trendy names are getting into paraphernalia in a big way. All that and more coming up on the Noon Business Hour.
Loaning useful information each weekday. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
The squabble between Tesla CEO Elon Musk and the Securities and Exchange Commission continues. We'll cover that in our next segment. But right now, a record 14 candidates are on the ballot for today's Chicago mayoral election. Let's discuss the historic vote and its potential impact on the city's economy with Greg Hines, columnist for Crane Chicago Business. Greg, welcome back to the program. 6 hours into voting in Chicago, and it looks like it will be a historic day when it comes to historically low turnout. And Greg, with so few people going to the polls right now, who does that seem to favor?
Well, let me break that down a little bit more. You're right that turnout so far is not great. There was a lot of theory before this election started, or a big question anyhow, that millennials, who turned out in big numbers in the November national elections, would they turn out for the mayoral? Well, they seem not to. According to early data from the Board of Elections so far, more people over age 65 have voted than everybody under age 44. Okay, that's just remarkable. It's certainly bad news for some of the candidates who have tried to appeal to younger people. Amara Enya, for one, probably Susana Mendoza. It could help some of the older candidates, some of the graybeards, maybe Bill Daley, maybe Paul Vallis, maybe Tony Preckwinkle, because they've been around a while and older voters know them pretty well. But it is remarkable given how much excitement you would think there would be around this election.
It's interesting to note, though, with 14 candidates, no one has either emerged as the candidate that has 100% of one particular group. There is no one who was the progressive darling. There isn't really a candidate who you could say is kind of the darling of the bungalow belt. I mean, maybe Bill Daley is that person, but not 100% that person. So it seems that with the lack of a true champion for some interest group somewhere in Chicago, maybe that's driving down turnout as well.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. I suspect a lot of voters went into the voting booth and did their own version of eeny, meeny, miny, moe. You just can't get your arms around 14, and every possible fraction of the electorate is split. There's multiple African-American candidates. There's multiple Latino candidates. There's multiple older white ethnic candidates. There's multiple progressives. There's two or three conservatives. So every lane, as it were, is all split up. That makes it, and just in the sheer number, makes it very difficult to kind of break through and capture the public's imagination. And apparently the reaction is, yawn, we'll wait until the runoff.
Well, you have two candidates. So let's talk about two candidates who have received powerful endorsements. First off, Bill Daley, who has gotten Ken Griffin, the hedge fund billionaire, to open up his checkbook and write some substantial checks. But you also have Tony Preckwinkle, who has received the endorsement of the Chicago's Teachers Union, an organization that has really flexed its political might over the past 6 or 7 years. And it'll be interesting to see which one carries more weight tonight.
Yeah, if anybody has a little bit of an edge today, it would be those two, both because of the endorsements and because of what the endorsements can do for them. They have field troops. They have people out ringing doorbells who can pull out voters. That's terrifically important. A third candidate, Lori Lightwood, has kind of seemed to have surged a little bit lately and has tried to play off. That is the anti-Daley and the anti-Preckwinkle. But she doesn't have those field troops, and she doesn't have a lot of money. So the question for her is how valuable is that momentum going to be? How far is it going to propel her?
And whoever advances tonight, I mean, this is like the NCAA tournament, survive in advance. Whoever advances tonight and then moves on in April, the number one economic challenge they face will be the pension situation.
Yeah, the city's budget does indeed have problems. Everybody who lives in the city knows how much taxes have gone up in the last few years, almost all of it to pay for pensions that weren't paid for before. We're going to have to do roughly again what we've already done. We're going to have to put another $1 billion into the pot, or if lightning strikes and the courts let us cut back on the benefits somehow. That's going to be painful. Somebody's going to have to spend some political capital, and voters aren't going to want it. But the Illinois Supreme Court seemed to have locked us into that situation. So far, they've said, nope, you got to pay it. And the new governor, J.B. Pritzker, is unwilling to amend the state constitution without his support. It's probably not going to happen. So that only leaves one choice, pay up.
Well, thanks as always for the insights on the local political scene. Greg Hines, a columnist, Crane Chicago Business. And, of course, stay with WBBM throughout the afternoon. We'll keep you up to speed on how the voting is going. And then at 7 o'clock tonight when the polls close. Tune in to News Radio. We'll have the results as they come in. We'll bring you the speeches live as well. Coming up, Elon Musk lashing out at government regulators.
Discussing the news affecting your money. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
The war of words is escalating between Tesla CEO Elon Musk and the Securities and Exchange Commission. Let's get the latest now from Benjamin Bain, reporter for Bloomberg News based in Washington. Ben, what is this? What are the details on what is essentially round two in Musk versus the SEC?
Yeah, round two, and it's probably not gonna be the last. So if last week Musk sent out a couple of tweets, and the first one he gave some delivery production numbers, basically, which he then later corrected. And you know, the problem for Musk is that if you remember back in August, he had a now infamous tweet where he said he was considering taking the company private and he had funding secured. That was news to everyone, including the SEC regulators and investors, and you know that wasn't how the head of a large publicly traded company is supposed to go about disclosing that information. So he reached a settlement with the SEC, basically saying that he was going to have someone mind his tweets. Someone was going to make sure he wasn't releasing details like he did last week without having someone look at them. In this case, that didn't happen. The SEC took issue with that because that was part of their settlement, and here we are back. And Musk versus SEC, as you said, round two.
Is this a situation that if it were to happen again, outside of sanctions from the SEC, is this a possibility that Tesla could find some way to wall him off?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when you talk to people about Musk and Tesla, you know, they say basically Musk is Tesla and Tesla, you know, is Musk. So I think probably the worst case scenario for most people who are bulls for Tesla is a situation when you talk to them where Musk is kind of cut out. But by doing what he did last week and again having the SEC, you know, yesterday asking, you know, a federal judge to essentially hold him in contempt of court, it again opens up these legal perils. And yeah, the parade of horribles, you know, goes all the way up to the point that you're talking about where there's some type of new restriction placed on his involvement in the company potentially or other types of, you know, limits in terms of how he can be the one calling the shots. You know, Musk has always been the face of Tesla. And, you know, to the extent that the company succeeds and people are betting on Tesla, they're really betting on Musk. And again, now here we are, you know, 5 months after the settlement, again, wondering, you know, what the future for Musk is going to hold with Tesla.
It sounds like the lesson, especially in the tech space, you have a lot of CEOs and funders who try to cultivate an image of being a disruptor, either with disruptive business practices or unorthodox communication. But if you actually are disruptive and don't have the image, and it's not just the image or marketing, there could be serious consequences.
Yeah, I mean, and there's also, I think there's also kind of, you know, a question of being disruptive, and there's a question of almost kind of poking the bear hair. I mean, you know, Musk went on an interview on CBS's 60 Minutes and basically in December said, you know, he didn't respect the SEC. You know, back in September when he, you know, was right around the time of the settlement, he called the SEC a short seller enrichment commission and kind of his reference to his longstanding feud with people who are betting against, you know, the success of Tesla and him. So, you know, there's obviously disruption and then there, you know, from a regulator's perspective, there's you know, there's kind of just basically, you know, poking the bear.
Well, thank you very much, Benjamin Bain, reporter for Bloomberg News based in Washington. We'll have the latest in market news coming up next. WBBM News Time, 1225, WBBM Business News from Bloomberg, and here's Jeff Bellinger.
And Rob, optimism on trade carried the day on Wall Street yesterday. That has eased, and the markets had trouble getting any traction today. Dow Jones Industrials are off by just a fraction, 26,090. The Nasdaq's down 7 points. The S&P 500 is down by a fraction. The Wintrust WBBM Chicago Index from Bloomberg is down 0.2%. AT&T has beaten back another effort to prevent it from acquiring Time Warner. A federal appeals court ruled the Justice Department failed to establish that a lower court judge was in error, rejecting the government's case that the deal should be blocked on antitrust grounds. Time now to check in with Pete Manhart at Bates Commodities. Hi, Pete.
Hi, and we have lower grain prices today. Corn down another 4 in March at 366.5. May down 4.25. Beans are down 8 to 9 today. And wheat, after yesterday being down 16 to 18, down another 5. Lower across the board. And this is Pete Manhart at Bates Commodities in Normal.
And shares of Home Depot are under pressure. The stock is down 2%. The chain's quarterly results fell short of forecast today. With business at 25 and 55, live from the Bloomberg Newsroom, Jeff Bellinger, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
WBBM News Time, 1230. Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart, and these are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Stocks are sluggish today. We'll see what's holding back the markets. In Travel Tuesday, using a credit card or an airline loyalty program to save money on flights. Upscale retail is getting in on the legalized marijuana action. Chicago voters sort through 14 candidates for mayor on today's ballot and choose aldermen, a city treasurer, and a city clerk. The White House seeks to discredit President Trump's former personal lawyer as he makes a series of appearances on Capitol Hill. WBBM Business, the Dow is down 13 points, the Nasdaq is down 11, the S&P 500 down 1.5. AccuWeather says cloudy and cold with a bit of snow or flurries this afternoon, but not much in the way of accumulation. A high today of 26, it's 22 degrees in Chicago at 12:31 as the Noon Business Hour continues, presented by Old Second Bank. And markets are hovering near the flat line. We're joined now by Paul Nolte, portfolio manager at Kingsview Asset Management based in Chicago. Paul, it would seem as the housing sector goes, so does Home Depot.
No, that's true. And actually, historically, what we've seen in a slowing housing market is actually a lot more people willing to stay where they're at and fix up the place a little bit. Home Depot had very good numbers prior quarter. Here, I think they just missed some estimates. But overall, I think the Home Depot numbers actually look pretty good from the long-term perspective. But you're right, from a short-term perspective, people are taking a little bit of profits after a nice run.
You bring up a very good point, and that is you can talk about the number of people who are buying houses or knocking them down and building new ones. But Home Depot numbers also reflect people who do want to stay and remodel their own home. And if you want to get a water heater or cabinets, where else do you go but the big box hardware store?
No, it's true. And one of the things, too, if you take a look at the housing numbers, there's actually we're starting to see some of the impact from the tax law in the housing data, in the fact that some of the top-end houses, especially in some of those parts of the country where real estate taxes are fairly high, are really kind of struggling. So I think if you take a look at the housing numbers and kind of pull them apart a little bit, the median and below housing numbers are actually pretty good. It's at the high end that's being impacted by the change in tax legislation that are really kind of struggling at this point.
Is that something we're going to see in the next couple of months as people take out all of their W-2s and they do their taxes and then they realize that the refund that they were counting on will be relatively light or non-existent? Will there be an impact, let's say, in April or May?
I think there will be some in some of the retail sales numbers. Historically, you see a little bit of a pickup in the April-May period as those get refunded and look to maybe spend a little bit, save a little bit. So we're not quite sure. We're hearing all the stories, but we're not quite sure until everybody actually gets through their taxes what the impact is going to be across the board as far as whether we get a refund or not. And, from strictly a financial planning perspective, you really don't want to have a big refund because that essentially is a free government loan that you're making to them. So you'd like to have that adjusted as you go through. So depending on what your taxes do, take a look at your withholdings after this tax season.
Consumer confidence really popped in the past month, and at first glance, it would seem like that's the government shutdown rolling off the books.
It is, and two, I think we've got probably another month and a half of data to get through, to get caught up from the government shutdown, as well as start to see the data numbers come in without the government shutdown impact. So I think we probably have a few more months to get through first, and then hopefully maybe we'll get a trade deal as well, and then that will also create some issues in the numbers that we see until that all rolls in and starts to lap over the course of the year.
Fed Chair Jerome Powell delivered testimony saying the economy is healthy, but also added the Fed is seeing cross currents and conflicting signals. And that assessment seems to line up with the assessment of a lot of the guests on this program. Things seem okay, but ...
That's true. And, that was part of and what we've been trying to really parse out is the change from their tenor just in the last 3-4 months. Certainly they moved to a very more dovish stance, more cautious, and we're seeing it in a lot of the financial markets. The chances of a Fed raising rates are essentially zero for this year and actually a cut next year. And we all kind of wondered, what are they seeing? And we're starting to see it in some of the economic data. It's a little bit softer. Not recessionary, but certainly warranting the Fed maybe to step back a little bit, wait a little while, see how some of the numbers and how the economic data flows before they start to either raise rates or reduce their balance sheet.
As negotiators from Washington work on trying to reach some sort of new trade deal with China, what would be considered a good deal for the United States? I mean, we know President Trump will go on Twitter the moment a deal is announced and say it's the greatest deal in the history of deals. That's a given. But when economists and the business community looks under the hood, what do they have to see to say it's a good deal?
I think really the core of it really needs to be around technology and information flow, proprietary information, all of those things that a lot of the other countries around the world have pointed to issues with China in taking a lot of technology from those countries, from those companies within those countries. I think that's really going to be at the crux. If we don't see any type of movement there, we're going to have some trouble. If it's just buying grains or buying more cars or whatever it is, I don't think that's going to be a long-term solution. I think really the technology issue is going to be has to be at the heart of whatever deal gets done.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Paul Nolte, Portfolio Manager at Kingsview Asset Management in Chicago. Coming up next in Travel Tuesday, getting the most of your credit card points and airline loyalty programs.
Investing 60 minutes each weekday toward planning for the future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Travel Tuesday, sponsored by Kaler Luggage. And this afternoon, we're looking at ways to maximize airline loyalty programs and credit card points. We welcome in Ted Rossman, an industry analyst at creditcards.com based in New York. Ted, welcome to the program. If you want to get all the perks that come with airline rewards programs, whether it's upgrades or tickets that you can purchase with exclusively points, do you have to be a road warrior, or can you do all of that off of your airline credit card?
These days, most people are earning most of their miles from everyday spending on credit cards, and that includes sign-up bonuses. So you don't need to actually be in the airline seat all that often to earn a free trip.
And what's the best, do you have to get a specific airline credit card, or are there some credit cards that are ecumenical when it comes to applying points to airline travel?
The cards that I like the best are the transferable points cards. Examples include Chase and American Express. My favorite is the Chase Sapphire Reserve because you can pool these points and transfer them to more than a dozen different partners. That includes United Airlines, Southwest Airlines, Marriott Hotels. There's a bunch of international airlines as well. The beauty in this, just like diversifying your stocks, is diversifying your points and miles. So if one airline devalues their program, or if one airline doesn't happen to fly where you want to go, you've got a whole bunch of options that you can transfer into.
Is there a robust marketplace or competition inside the airline industry or inside the credit card industry to really chase after customers with miles that really go farther or can bring in more generous benefits?
It's definitely a hot area. The airlines make literally billions of dollars from the credit card companies because they sell their miles and then the credit card companies use them as marketing incentives. The offers are not quite as generous as they were a few years ago. That Chase Sapphire Reserve card I mentioned launched 3 years ago with great fanfare, 100,000 point bonus, and really shook up the industry. It's done very well. It's also come at a marketing cost to Chase. So industry-wide, there's been a little more restraint lately when it comes to these sign-up bonuses. Issuers are trying to push customers more to ongoing rewards, like maybe getting 4 or even 5 points per dollar that you spend on dining. But you can still get good sign-up bonuses in the neighborhood of 50,000 points, maybe $750 in free travel.
We live in Chicago or in the Chicago area, so the big airlines here, of course, are United, American, and then Southwest at Midway Airport. A lot of people do have a United or a Southwest or an American Airlines credit card. Of those three, what would you say is kind of the best one for an air traveler?
Southwest is amazing because of their companion pass. If you accumulate 110,000 points, and some of that can be on your credit card, you can have somebody come with you for free on all of your trips for the rest of that year. So that's an amazing perk there. If you happen to like Southwest, you can find value on all these carriers, though. United, out of those, probably has the most attractive international partners with the Star Alliance. So I often urge people to work backwards. Think about where you want to go, and then look at which airlines and which credit cards can help get you there for free.
Well, thank you very much. Ted Rossman, industry analyst at creditcards.com. Join us at this time tomorrow for Personal Finance Wednesday. And still to come, stores are looking to cash in on legalized pot.
Because money matters. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Barney's New York is set to unveil a shop selling marijuana-related items, including glass pipes and 24-karat gold rolling papers at its Beverly Hills flagship next month. Let's discuss cannabis and retail with Michael Palumbo, manager of the TMT Perseverance Fund and author of the book Calculated Risk. Mike, welcome back to the program. This seemed inevitable, didn't it? As soon as the states began decriminalizing marijuana, not only were companies going to jump into the marijuana business, actually, you know, growing it and selling it, but also into the upscale paraphernalia business too.
Yeah, good afternoon, Rob. Thanks for having me on. You know, where there's money to be made, you know, there's going to be some competition moving into the industry. So what happened here is as you said, it's slowly been rolling out legally in various states, California being one of the first to go recreationally legal. So now you have Barney's being willing to sell high-end paraphernalia for cannabis, so they're entering the industry as well. It's going to get competitive, but you know, I think it's going to be a lucrative industry for folks that really know what they're doing.
What would happen though if the federal prohibition on marijuana ended? Because we have talked to people on this program before, and they have said, we don't recommend marijuana stocks, we don't recommend cannabis companies, we don't lend to a marijuana business because this is still considered a Schedule I narcotic by the federal government, and we technically don't want to break the law.
So here's the two phases that we have to look at. First of all, you have to look at the banking. So what the government could, what the feds could do is allow for the banking of these companies, because right now, because it's federally illegal, anybody that has an FDIC guarantee is afraid to bank these companies. So it's become an all-cash business for the most part, which makes it, you know, difficult to run these cannabis shops. That would be the first thing to fall. I think that's going to happen, possibly even this year. Then the bigger issue is whether they take it off Schedule I or not. You mentioned Schedule I, and that's basically for the most dangerous drugs in America. That includes heroin and cocaine. And right now, marijuana is included on this Schedule I. And I think a lot of people using common sense would say that probably is not where it belongs. But as of right now, it still is. So that would be the second part. That may or may not happen. And we'll have to see. You know, the House is now under Democrat control. They're more pro-cannabis than the Republicans, so it might happen. But you know, there's many phases to this change, and it's coming. It's just a matter of when and how far they go. But the Schedule I is the big one, because that would then make it legal for all states to have it recreationally, and then it would open up things like mergers with Canadian companies. You'll see a lot, and then it would allow for bigger companies to come in and invest in the U.S. market. Right now, you've got companies like Philip Morris and also Constellation Brands. They have stakes in Canadian companies because it's legal federally there, but they're afraid of the U.S. market right now. So we will see what happens as things develop. But if they do open it up and take it off Schedule I, you'll see mergers in the industry, and these companies that are in the U.S., which traded a significant discount to the Canadian companies, that discount probably will go away, or at least get shrunk a lot, because right now a lot of people are nervous about buying U.S. companies. I think that will change, but it's going to take some time.
Thanks a lot, Michael Palumbo, manager of the TMT Perseverance Fund and author of the book Calculated Risk. Business coming up next. WBBM News Time, 12:56. Now business news from Bloomberg and Jeff Bellinger.
And Rob, key indexes just slightly lower. Dow Jones Industrials are down 10 points. The NASDAQ is down 7. S&P 500 is down 1. The Wintrust WBBM Chicago Index from Bloomberg is down 0.7%. Crude oil futures also not doing a lot. They're down 0.3% this hour. With business at 25 and 55 from the Bloomberg Newsroom, Jeff Bellinger, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM.
WBBM and HD Chicago, WCFS-FM and HD1 Elmwood Park.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.